Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties and Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Groups. It was recorded on Tuesday, March 26, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the oral argument that took place earlier today in the highly anticipated Prop 8 case in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our expert of about 10 to 12 minutes, followed by your questions. Our expert for both today and tomorrow's DOMA case will be Carrie Severino. Carrie Severino is Chief Counsel and Policy Director at the Judicial Crisis Network, where she has briefed senators and congressmen on judicial nominations. You've likely seen her in one of her many appearances on MSNBC, Fox, C-SPAN, and other networks. She was previously a law clerk to Judge David Sentelle of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and then for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. And with that, Carrie Severino, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks so much. I want to start by giving a little bit of a history of this case, both just so everyone knows what it's about clearly, and also because some of the procedural background of the case actually could turn out to be the issues the case turns on ultimately, because it has to do with issues of standing. So a quick summary, California, of course, originally, like all other states, recognized marriage as only between a man and a woman, and this until this century was not a very novel proposition. But in the year 2000, California decided, because there were other states that were making moves towards same-sex marriage, to have a proposition. California has a very robust initiative process, and this proposition would have changed the law in California, made the law in California very clear to define marriage as between a man and a woman. That was called Proposition 22, and that was passed in the year 2000. This was then challenged by California residents as being unconstitutional under the California Constitution, and ultimately in May of 2008, the California Supreme Court did decide that the Equal Protection Clause of the California State Constitution gave a special protected class for gender, for sexual orientation, and that meant that defining marriage as between a man and a woman could not survive strict scrutiny. So that effectively required same-sex marriage as a matter of California constitutional law. So that would have been limited to the state of California. Seeing the direction this case was going, there were some movements to then change the California Constitution that began before the Supreme Court. The California Supreme Court handed it down, but ultimately were voted on afterwards. And that's where the subject of this case comes in. That's Proposition 8. It was another ballot initiative in California. And this, instead of making a law, would amend the California Constitution to say whatever the California Supreme Court says it means before, we're going to make this very clear. Under the California Constitution, marriage is between a man and a woman. Now California does grant basically every other right in state law in terms of adoption, in terms of state taxes, et cetera, to same-sex couples, but it would reserve the word marriage in the status of marriage for male-female couples. This was passed in May 2008. The California Supreme Court said the California Constitution requires same-sex marriage. In November, Proposition 8 passed. So there's a six-month span during which there were marriages conducted in California, same-sex marriages, and then the Constitution was changed to say, no, there is no same-sex marriage in the California Constitution. So this, of course, spawned its own round of litigation, and that's the litigation we're seeing coming to fruition today. In July 2008, this case was originally filed. It challenged Proposition 8. Now, because it was a matter of California constitutional law, it was clearly okay in California, but they challenged it as a matter of the federal constitution, because any law under the Supremacy Clause that violates the federal constitution, even if it's in the state constitution, it's not allowed. So they said this violates the Equal Protection Clause of the federal constitution. That's found in the 14th Amendment, passed in 1868, but they said that it denies equal protection of the laws to gays and lesbians who want to get married. There was a sweeping decision in the district court in the Northern District of California in 2010, where that judge determined that the federal constitution did require same-sex marriage, basically would have required throughout all 50 states under his reasoning. He said that the Equal Protection Clause does require that. That was then, of course, appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit also found that that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional, but on a much narrower ground. They said, once you have granted all of these rights to same-sex couples to marry, now you can't take it away. To do that would be an act of pure prejudice, irrational, and purely out of animus against a group. So that is not allowed. But that ruling would have allowed states that say had never had same-sex marriage to continue in their situation. And that was a 2-1 decision by a Ninth Circuit panel. In the process, the Ninth Circuit also decided another issue, which is going to turn out to be potentially crucial in this case, and that is who has standing to bring the case. In federal courts, you need to have standing to sue and bring and carry on a lawsuit. That means you have to have suffered some kind of injury that's redressable by the court. You can't just have any person off the street bringing a lawsuit. And in this case, the California state was unwilling to defend its own law. So normally the attorney general and the governor of the state would defend Proposition 8 as part of the California Constitution, because they're required to defend that in federal court. They declined to do so. It parallels in some ways the way that President Obama has declined to defend DOMA, which we can talk about more tomorrow. But because they declined to do so, the proponents of Proposition 8 are the ones who are actually litigating this case. It's some of the groups and the people that were behind getting this amendment passed in the first place. And since the Ninth Circuit wasn't sure whether they would have standing to do so, they asked the California courts to decide that question. The California court said, as a matter of California law, that when the California state government does not step in to defend its own law, then we can have another group like the proponents of this referendum initiative to defend that in court. So the California state court said they do have standing. They're representing California as a matter of California state law. That was good enough for the Ninth Circuit. They said, great, we'll go on with this case, but they did ultimately find Proposition 8 unconstitutional, and that's how it was appealed to the Supreme Court. So today we heard argued two major issues. The first is going back to the standing issue, and that was whether the Proposition 8 proponents really do have standing to bring this case in federal court. If they don't, it could wipe out the entire history of this case so far. I mean, they wouldn't have had standing to argue the case all the way down to the district court, and the case could have just failed by default, which presumably means that Proposition 8 would fall, but not for any real legal reason, just for lack of anyone to stand up and defend it. And this is an issue that, although the court didn't allow extra time for arguing it, tomorrow actually they have extra time to argue some of these procedural issues, it was something that was clearly forefront in their mind. Chief Justice Roberts interrupted all three of the people arguing today and made them start out not with where they wanted to start, which was the merits of the case, should the Equal Protection Clause cover same-sex marriage, but let's go back and say, can we even hear this case in the first place? And so we saw, from my count, actually there's a potential 5 votes to drop this case on standing in and of itself. Justice Ginsburg started out saying, why do these people that brought the initiative and different than any other citizen? If we say they can bring a case, couldn't any California citizen who voted for Proposition 8 now bring a case in federal court? We saw Justice Sotomayor echoed sort of the same thing. Justice Breyer pointed to the existence in many states of a right of public action where public citizens can just bring an action to vindicate the rights of and uphold laws in court. He said federal law doesn't have that, so this is different. Even if as a matter of state law they could defend it, as a matter of federal law, this is going to be different. And Justice Kagan also said it seems absurd that you could delegate any member of the public to just be your defender of the law when the government will not step up. Those are the 4 liberal members of the court that clearly said that. And I think Chief Justice Roberts also suggested that he had some real questions about regardless of California's position on this, whether that really is enough for federal standing, because that's going to be a different question than simply as a matter of state law. So I think there's a real possibility we'll see Chief Justice Roberts decide there is no standing in this case. Interestingly, Justice Kennedy, who's generally seen as a swing vote, and I think will probably be the swing vote in this case, seemed fairly clearly pro-standing in this case. He said, look, the representatives here are distinguishable from any other citizen. They all, as a member of this group, had to pay money to promote the initiative. They were all active in it, and it's a distinguishable group that was designated by the state itself. There's also the danger that was raised by Justice Kennedy, Justice Alito as well, that if in states that have this referendum process, we don't allow federal standing for the proponents of the initiative or for someone other than the state government, you could easily be in a situation where you'd grant an effective veto to a hostile governor and or attorney general. The whole idea of having a state referendum process is that the citizens of the state don't really trust everything to the delegated legislative system, their representatives. They want to have some things where they have direct democracy and direct action to vote on an issue. And so it would be strange to then allow the governor, by just saying, I'm not going to defend this law, to be able to effectively veto the vote of the majority of the citizens of that state. So those are some of the concerns raised in people in favor of it going along with California's determination that this group does have standing. All of the parties actually seem to agree that there could be certain circumstances where the state could appoint another person to bring a lawsuit when the governor and the attorney general are not willing to do so. I think the difference between the parties is that the opponents of Proposition 8 said it's not enough to have the state court do it. You would have to have some kind of specific act by the governor or the legislature itself, appointing a specific person with a fiduciary duty to carry on the case, whereas it seems like Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, Justice Alito all were happy to say if the state court says it, it's a matter of state law. Assuming that the case does get past the standing issue, which Chief Justice Roberts didn't come down in as solid a way as I heard some of the liberal justices come down in their concerns on standing, then I think actually it's going to be a very close case and could easily go in the direction of allowing states to continue to determine their own interests in terms of marriage law. The main question is whether the Equal Protection Clause it requires same-sex marriage across the board, and that would really require all 50 states to mandate it, versus allowing states to experiment on their own. One thing that makes me think that we may see a decision allowing the states to continue to do that is we've seen Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy recently in public comments before the arguments both state their concerns about situations where the court has taken a important social issue that was very divisive out of the hands of the democratic process and bring it into the courts, and that's something that caused a lot of social upheaval. The parallel they often cite is Roe versus Wade, where 40 years later we're still seeing how it affects and permeates really the political process. There are still people marching on Washington about this decision. And Justice Ginsburg herself, a very strong proponent of abortion rights, has said she thinks maybe that case was too sweeping, too much too soon, and would have preferred a more stepwise approach. Justice Kennedy talked about it in terms of democratic sovereignty and maybe we should let the people decide rather than unelected judges decide. Both of those point to the fact that they're not going to want to make a broad decision in this case saying for all 50 states, we do have 9 states that have allowed same-sex marriage, but for the rest of them, it would fundamentally change state law and take this issue out of the hands of the people and their elected representatives. And I think that's something that most of the justices are going to be hesitant to do. So that leaves then very few options if we do get to the merits on this case. One option that has been floated as a potential narrower decision that might allow Proposition 8 to fall in California but wouldn't affect other states is the one that has been advocated by the United States as amicus in this case, and they actually had separate time to argue toward the end of arguments, not just the opponents of Proposition 8, but the United States and the Solicitor General did the argument. So their position is that when a state has granted almost all of the rights associated with marriage, or when they have granted it, that now you can't, you have to go all the way. And you can't, you somehow lose the ability to argue, for example, that there's a state interest in child rearing and therefore in opposite sex marriage and traditional marriage, because you've granted them the right to adopt or the right to engage in fertility treatments or something like that. And so now you have to go all the way and grant the right to marriage. That argument, interestingly, was really soundly rejected by members on both sides of the court. It was interesting, even Justice Breyer said the real harm here is not, they were talking about who's harmed, is the institution of marriage harmed, are the same-sex couples or their children harmed. He said the real harm is you asking me to try to make this statement that this law applies and raises a higher standard, effectively requiring same-sex marriage in states that have done more to accommodate same-sex couples than it does in a state that has given, say, no rights whatsoever to a same-sex couple. And he was concerned that this is going to create an incentive for states not to grant rights to same-sex couples, because once you grant a few, you might be then required constitutionally to grant all of them. So I think from a legal perspective, that's right, that that's not a very principled position that the United States took in this case. It reflects a little bit of the splitting the baby effect, I think, that the Ninth Circuit was attempting to do, of how do we find a narrow decision that will create same-sex marriage in California or preserve it, but while not affecting other states. Given the fact that it looks like there's not a lot of interest in the court in taking that narrower decision, it suggests to me that if it gets to the merits, the actual narrowest option is to really just allow states to determine their own law. If you're faced with a choice of either saying that the Equal Protection Clause requires same-sex marriage throughout the country or saying states can work this out as they see fit, I think you're going to see the justices that would rather look at how the states are doing this as they see fit. And it was interesting, the very closing statement that Chuck Cooper made on behalf of the proponents of Proposition 8 was interesting, pointing out that even in California, this issue is not settled. As Justice Alito pointed out at one point, California has amended its constitution 500 times. Even though it has amended its constitution now to provide for marriage, it's only between a man and a woman, there's nothing to prevent it from amending it again. And that was something that at least some of the justices pointed out as an asset of allowing this to stay within the states. That allows them to experiment with various levels of civil unions, domestic partnerships, et cetera. There was also a lot of concern that we heard about whether the sociological evidence that was introduced was of any value really whatsoever. Justice Kennedy pointed out, and even Justice Sotomayor echoed at one point, that we're looking here at 5 to 10 years of experience, even worldwide, with the institution of same-sex marriage versus thousands of years of history, and that it might be reasonable for states to engage in caution. Even the United States, that was arguing about in favor in general of promoting same-sex marriage, said that this caution argument might be the strongest one that they saw. So those were some real signs the court might not go all the way. That said, there were also some definite statements from Justice Sotomayor talking about how sexual orientation is clearly a class, linking it to racial discrimination. And Justice Ginsburg did a very similar statements and talked about how it was trying to make some parallels to the Loving versus Virginia case, which was a case that outlawed anti-miscegenation laws. So there's a definite parallel there. Justice Kagan made some statements that showed that she really doesn't buy the argument that procreation is a fundamental issue in marriage. She pointed out that we don't deny marriage licenses to people who are over age 55, and connected the sterility argument that we don't deny licenses to people to sterile couples. So how can you say it's about procreation is actually a right the state is interested in? Justice Breyer pointed that out as well. So I think you see those four who would be inclined to go towards same-sex marriage, but again, perhaps are hesitant to do so just as a practical matter in terms of trying to find a way to make this a stepwise decision. So I guess in conclusion, it's still a close case. I'm more more than going into it, I'm thinking there's actually a possibility we will see a case come down in a way that leaves the states in control of their own marriage laws, and we'll just have to see how that interacts with the DOMA case tomorrow. But there's also a very decent chance that the way that the court will find to not have to make that sweeping decision that it doesn't want to make will be that it just bumps this entire case on standing in some way that would be disappointing, certainly for all the groups that have been involved in briefing the incredible amount of time and effort that's gone into the case. But that's a real possibility given the arguments today. So thank you very much, and we'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you. If you joined us late, we're listening to Carrie Severino today, who attended the oral argument this morning in the Supreme Court on the Prop 8 case. Let's do check in with the audience, see what's on their mind today. We've got about 260 people on the line. In a moment, we should all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, you'll need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Carrie Severino, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience questions, let me make our programming announcement. We've already referenced tomorrow's Supreme Court oral argument in the DOMA case, sort of a companion case with today's case. Carrie Severino will join us again on a call just like today at 1 p.m. At this same number. On Thursday, at this same number at 1 p.m., we'll be discussing the Horn case, which concerns raisin growers and compelled fees that they must pay for the privilege of growing raisins. Next week, we have a handful of cases. On Monday, we'll be talking about an intellectual property case, the Kirstein case. On Tuesday, we'll talk about prosecuting financial firms. And then on Thursday, we'll have a special telephone conference call with Federal Society founder Professor Stephen Calabresi and Seventh Circuit Chief Judge Frank Easterbrook talking about Judge Robert Bork, his legacy in life, and his final book. With that, let's go to our first caller.
Ms. Severino, thank you very much for your information today. I have a question relating to the narrow ground issue, the narrow grounds for overturning Proposition 8. You suggested that there was some skepticism, at least on the part of Justice Breyer and then perhaps other justices, with respect to the problem of if they were to find that on the narrow grounds that Proposition 8 should be invalidated because of the equality between marriage and the domestic partnership laws in California, that would create a reverse incentive for states not to provide anything close to marriage for fear that they would be required to grant marriage. So given that, my question relates to something that I saw reported in the newsprint regarding a question to Chuck Cooper with respect to whether or not there were other circumstances that he could think of in the law where you could have this difference, the way that the question was put to him, suggesting that you could treat gays and lesbians in a different manner, for instance, in employment. Why, or is there anything other than marriage and where you could have this distinction? I saw reported that Mr. Cooper said that he could not think of any. I interject my own opinion here, and that may not ask the right question, because how you define marriage between a man and a woman doesn't necessarily, that's not the same question as whether or not you're making distinctions based on employment. But I just wanted to ask about that and your thoughts on how the justices reacted to that question. If Justice Breyer seems skeptical of that narrow grand argument, were there other suggestions that such a narrow ruling might be possible, that there might be a majority of justices weighing in on that?
Yeah. First, thanks for bringing up Chuck Cooper's point, because I think that was a good statement to highlight. I thought it was surprising, actually, that he didn't have something in his pocket just to come up with for that. That was a question posed by Justice Sotomayor, and his answer was, I cannot. I don't have anything to offer you. But he did then follow it up with an interesting comment, which was, he said, that doesn't mean that it's a class. The really, if a state is making a completely irrational law based that affects any group, it doesn't have to be a protected class like race or sex or something, then that would fail rational basis tests. Here we're just talking about, does it pass a rational basis test? So is there a rational basis for making this law under these circumstances? So he says, nothing else comes to mind that wouldn't have an irrational, this is the only one that comes to mind that has a rational connection to sexual orientation. Maybe there's some other that could come up, you could come up with that did, but I don't know of one. I mean, I think there are others you might be able to come up with, but I think he did come up with some answer to that. Just regarding the treatment of the government's position, Justice Breyer, I believe, was the only one who talked about the reverse incentive, but it was surprising to me even to see that basically there was a big pylon. I mean, Justice Ginsburg said, "Wait a minute, if you have a state that's made considerable progress, but now they're forced to go all the way. But if you've done nothing at all, that's okay. That seems strange." And Justice Sotomayor said the same thing. Why is it that states that do have fewer requirements, have more concessions to gays, have now this extra burden put on them if they have to go all the way? And so that's why I think we see, since we saw all of the maybe not all, most of the liberal justices who were very critical of that point, as well as some of the conservatives who jumped in on that, it strikes me that that's not something that's going to get very far.
Next question.
Hello, Carrie. This is Arthur Hellman. I actually missed the first part of it, so maybe you've answered this. But on the standing question, did they discuss whether, if the court finds the proponents don't have standing, what happens to the district court opinion? Does it stand, or does that get thrown out too?
The court didn't really address what would happen if we find no standing. I believe that's what would happen. I actually, Ed Whelan wrote a quick note on this earlier, and there was at least one other piece I remember reading earlier, but I've forgotten by whom, talking about this. I think our best guess would be that because if they really had no standing, then they didn't have standing to bring the district court case in the first place, and so all of the federal decisions at this point would be vacated. And so I guess it means that laws in this circumstance would just fail by default, or in this case it would be more of a straight default. That Justice Alito raised the problem of, you could also have a situation where the governor says he is going to defend the law but then offers a very weak defense of the law, and so it's really only pro forma that you have the defense, and that would provide the governor with some kind of a veto almost over any referendum, just simply by damning it with faint praise or by refusing to defend it at all.
Well, the reason I asked the question is that early on when the standing question was raised, a number of people were suggesting that if the court found no standing to appeal, that this would leave the district court decision to stand, which seemed to me like an extraordinary thing to do, a district court decision striking down an initiative allowed to stand because nobody is in the case with standing to appeal. But as I understand it, the Prop 8 proponents also defended the law in the district court, and the governor refused there also. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, but I have to go back and double-check the timeline of when the governor – but I believe he actually was talking about even vetoing the law or the referendum at some point. So I suspect he wasn't defending it at that point. I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Yeah, the Eastman, who else was on that brief with John Eastman, I think gave the chronology to suggest that, which I had not previously realized. I thought that initially the governor had at least made a token of defending the initiative.
I think he did make a token, but I'm not at this point I'm not sure whether it was at the Proposition 22 stage even or at Proposition 8, and if it even lasted all the way to trial. So we have to go back and confirm the timeline on that.
Okay, thank you. That's a pretty important, because that would give them an out if they said, but that would be, I think, a dubious legal holding, so I'm not sure they want to do that either. That would have pretty bad consequences for initiatives in California and other Western states.
Precisely.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got three callers in the queue right now with questions. After that, our lines will be open. Let's go to our next caller.
I just have a very limited technical question, not on the substantive issue, but in the historical discourse. You referred to Proposition 22 and then, of course, the one that's on the review now, 8. And I guess that 22 only applied on a statutory basis. Is there some way when you're in California and you want to do a proposition, you say, okay, this is only going to affect statutes and this is going to go in the Constitution? How does that work there?
I'm not familiar with all the details of the law of the referendum process, but my understanding is that Proposition 2, the target of the referendum was to amend a specific part of the California Family Code. So the referendum is you're voting on whether to amend the California law versus amending the California Constitution. So it would be clear when you're voting on it, or it should be clarified in the very bulky materials they provide, because they have a lot of referenda every year. But what you're doing, whether it's a legal change or a constitutional change.
Okay, that's fine. I understand. Thank you.
Go to our next caller.
Yes, my name is George Ball. I have a question about the levels of constitutional review. What were the specific arguments on rational basis versus strict scrutiny, and what were the questions or comments by the court?
I was surprised that they didn't go into great detail on that, and it seemed to be that the court was just presuming that we were going to be looking at rational basis scrutiny here, which is interesting. That you would think would be something that would be a focal point. And that certainly has been part of the circuit split that we've seen, and again with respect to DOMA as well. So maybe they'll get more into that tomorrow. It would have a huge difference in the way the case would come out. If it's rational basis scrutiny, it's a very low bar for the state to meet. All they have to do is show that there's a rational basis for this law, and whereas in strict scrutiny, they have to show that the government has a compelling interest and the law is narrowly tailored to that to meet that interest, or the constitutional amendment in this case, which is a much harder bar to cross, of course. It seemed to me that the court was just presuming we're going with rational basis. There wasn't a lot of discussion about how to deal with that. There were a few statements of why shouldn't this group be considered a class, but they didn't really go into details about is this really a protected class or not. I think the way the court has left it after Romer versus Evans, it seems like it is this quasi-protected class status. They applied what's often been termed as a sort of heightened rational basis review in that case, but that wasn't really a topic of discussion particularly today.
So the opponents didn't make the strict scrutiny argument?
They didn't go very strongly in that direction. No, they seemed to be focused more on the rational basis. They were just attacking the argument that procreation was even related to marriage, particularly in California, where they provide all of these other benefits, in particular benefits related to child rearing and custody and adoption, foster care, et cetera. And once you've given all of those things, you've basically given away the argument that you have a government interest in protecting the family structure in the context of procreation by having traditional marriage, because you've basically let them do everything else that you're letting a regular male-female couple do.
All right, thank you.
Carrie, we have a question by email. Let me read this to you. Equal protection under the 14th Amendment has never been applied to the institution of marriage other than in limited circumstance of Loving versus Virginia, and then only because the 14th Amendment speaks directly to racial discrimination. If the Supreme Court rules that equal protection under the 14th Amendment fully applies to the institution of marriage, could the ban on polygamy and plural marriage withstand a constitutional challenge, and particularly on the basis that such a ban constitutes religious discrimination against Mormons and Muslims? Is there any other more limited constitutional basis to strike the Prop 8 California marriage referendum?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think the way they're getting to finding equal protection right is because there are many cases that talk about marriage as a fundamental right. Now, depending on which side is quoting from the cases, you'll hear the quotes either about how it's important to the individual and is a central right that they have, and there are cases that allow, for example, marriage of someone who's incarcerated, and so they're saying, well, this can't have anything to do with procreation. Others talk about it as central to the survival of society itself and the family, and touch on some of these things that are clearly procreative and go toward the male-female union, is traditional understanding of marriage versus a purely relational personal fulfillment kind of interpretation, fulfillment of the individual interpretation of marriage. So it has been found to be a fundamental right, which then you would think couldn't be denied to a certain group over another. But I think it's definitely correct to wonder how this would affect polygamous issues. Basically, when that came up, it just in passing today, and I'm trying to find in my notes where specifically it was. I believe it was in a question to Ted Olson. He more or less just said, well, that's already been dealt with. We've already got a case saying that polygamy is not allowed in the case, and it has to do with issues of patriarchy and exploitation, et cetera. But I think he didn't fully answer that question, really, because certainly there are cases where there isn't necessarily exploitation. You could say there has to be a certain age range or a certain test of competence to make this determination, just as you would for any marriage. And so I think that doesn't fully answer the question. It may have even been Justice Sotomayor, I'm trying to find in my notes, that brought it up. But she said yes, and she said, what about incest? Maybe, you know, say once everyone's of an age of that they're able to consent, why can't we go there if we go here? So I'm assuming, coming from her, that this was potentially intent. She was hoping he would have a better clarification, but Ted Olson basically in the opposition to Prop 8 said more or less those are just different. He also clarified that polygamy has to do with conduct, where same-sex marriage has to do with a status or class. So I'm not they didn't go into detail on that. I'm not sure that would actually withstand a lot of scrutiny, because marriage actually is conduct in both cases, and it then just begs the question of why is marrying a man not the same kind of conduct as a man marrying a woman, or a man marrying two women or five women. So I think that wasn't really followed up on in the arguments, but it was more or less a, we've already discussed this issue. That said, it certainly, particularly in the environment where we're in now, where there's a lot of probing on the religious freedom rights and how far those can go, I think this is on a definite collision course with that, both in terms of can we force religious institutions, how far, what can we force them to do in terms of approving of or engaging in issues related to same-sex marriage, and also if you can have same-sex marriage because of this fundamental individual fulfillment right, why not in terms of part of one's fundamental religious beliefs? Why wouldn't that be an even higher and more robust reason to allow an alternate marriage structure?
Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Ben Carl calling from Washington, D.C. I really appreciate your analysis, and I just wanted to follow up with a couple of short questions. First one being, following up on your discussion just now about the comparison with incestuous relationships, and whether same-sex marriage is really an issue of sexual behavior as opposed to class status. I'm just curious, did the conservative you told us a lot about what are thought of more liberal judges on the court have been saying, but what did the conservative justices say about that issue, or really about any of the issues that you're discussing with regard to the appeal? And then following up on that, I'm very curious as to whether anyone actually on the bench challenged the comparison to the Loving versus Virginia case and the assertion that somehow racial classifications are the equivalent of homosexual or what you would call sexual orientation classifications. So I was curious as to whether that often repeated representation of proponents of same-sex marriage was ever actually challenged by anybody on the bench. And then finally, a case, the Romer v. Evans case is actually, I think that you may have mentioned that during your presentation. I was curious if Justice Roberts made any reference to that case during the oral argument today in his questioning, particularly given his role in as a private lawyer in preparing the proponents, remembering procedurally the people who were against the state's law in that particular case, whether Justice Roberts had anything to say about that case in today's argument.
Sure. So starting with the first one, just some of the memorable quotes, I guess, that I had highlighted from some of the conservative justices. In terms of the standing issue, mostly it was talking about the problems. Justice Alito talked about the problems this would cause undermining the initiative process, and Justice Kennedy called it a one-way ratchet if you don't allow their standing. And the merits, which is perhaps more interesting, I think Justice Scalia kept on pointing out this could have sweeping effects. What they're asking is a 50-state thing. So even if in California it would only affect the name marriage, and they would still, you'd still have the same kind of adoption rights or visitation rights or tax rights. In many other states, this would be a complete sea change in the law. So that seemed to be he wanted to remind everyone this is not a small stepwise kind of effort. Chief Justice Roberts made a couple interesting points talking about the way that the case had been framed as Ted Olson arguing against Prop 8 had it framed in the context of this is taking away rights from these married same-sex couples. And Chief Justice Roberts said, isn't it more reasonable to view this because the California Supreme Court is having made the change, not Proposition 8? California Supreme Court changed what had been from time immemorial the definition of marriage, and Proposition 8 really was just restoring that after a very brief six-month period. That was Ted Olson basically said, well, they found it as a matter of California constitutional law, so it was in the Constitution and presumably previously, but that actually led into Justice Scalia in a very extended discussion. I don't know if it could be called a discussion because it was more him repeatedly asking the same question, not feeling that he got a full answer. He said, when did this become unconstitutional? Because we're talking about the 14th Amendment, which was passed in 1868. Has this always been unconstitutional? 1791, when the founders first gave us the Constitution, 1868, when the 14th Amendment was passed, was it sometime in the 70s, but sometime after a case called Baker, which the court found that there wasn't even a federal question in terms of whether marriage would be this fundamental right to marriage for same-sex couples. So Ted Olson didn't really want to answer that question. He answered it rhetorically. He said, when did it become unconstitutional to prohibit miscegenation? And Justice Scalia said, that's easy, 1868. Now answer my question. Then they went back and forth, and Ted Olson didn't really seem to be wanting to come up with an answer. The closest he came was he said it became unconstitutional when we, as a culture, determined that sexual orientation is a characteristic people can't control. So he seemed to be embracing a understanding of constitutional development where once as a society we've determined that this is a fundamental characteristic that makes it kind of a class. Now it's brought in under the Equal Protection Clause. That didn't get followed up on completely, but then Chief Justice Roberts went back to the Proposition 8 case. He said if it would have been different if Proposition 8 came before the California Supreme Court, so if this were not allegedly taking something away versus just changing the position of marriage, and Ted Olson seemed to say yes, but maybe there's more because there's still this equal protection right once we've recognized this status. So that was a memorable sort of exchange. And I guess the other really interesting point that was brought up was that Chief Justice Roberts repeatedly said toward the end of Ted Olson's arguments, this is really just about a label. And he made one interesting parallel. He said, if you told a child that someone has to be your friend, you have to call so-and-so your friend, you might be able to get them to say that this is my friend, but you've fundamentally changed the meaning of what it is to be a friend. You can call him a friend, but that doesn't make him your friend in the sense that we mean friend. And he was pointing out that this, he said, you're now insisting on changing the definition of a label. And if you're requiring them to apply marriage to two men or two women, that actually changes, you want them to apply this label, but you've now changed the definition of the label. That really makes me confident that Justice Roberts, in terms of the merits, would really not be in favor of expanding same-sex marriage throughout the country. You mentioned Loving versus Virginia. It was discussed briefly, and I am not finding offhand which justice it was, but there was one justice who pointed out that Loving was it's an entirely different question in Loving versus Virginia, was the point that they were making, saying, look, this was something that is not. That actually was Justice Kennedy. I found it here. Ted Olson said Loving itself was going out into uncharted waters. You're not going to be going out into uncharted waters here without some precedent, I guess. Then Justice Kennedy said, yes, but there was a hundreds of years old in common law, so that's not accurate to say. So the fact that Justice Kennedy rejected the parallel to Loving versus Virginia suggests that he's not necessarily going to want to go all the way and call this an equal protection argument in the same way. And then in terms of Romer versus Evans, Chief Justice Roberts didn't really address that. In fact, it was interesting. There were some lawyers sitting behind me who had a bet on whether Chief Justice Roberts would even talk about the merits of the case at all. And I thought, until we got about halfway through, I thought the guy was going to win that said he wasn't going to, because he asked zero questions about the merits of the case, only talked about standing for the entire first set of arguments with Chuck Cooper, and then it was only once Ted Olson stood up to argue for the respondents that he started talking at all partway through that about the merits of the case. So he didn't really go into Romer versus Evans at all, although it certainly would have been interesting to hear his perspective. That said, the case was, of course, cited particularly because it was Justice Kennedy was on that decision, and Kennedy is widely seen, I think, accurately as a swing vote. So there were several references by the respondents, by Ted Olson, evoking Lawrence versus Texas, evoking Romer versus Evans, as well, of course, as Loving versus Virginia, and also Brown versus Board of Education, and trying to put this in a stream of cases where this is a great civil rights procession. And this fits in with his notion of jurisprudence.
The questions are piling up, Carrie, so we'll try to get to as many questions as we can. We have five in the queue at this point. Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Will Trachman in Denver, Colorado. Thanks so much for the great presentation. Two quick comments. I think in California, the very minor differences between amendments and statutory changes to the initiative process has to do with how many signatures you gather during the pre-voting stage. So if you gather 700,000 or so, you can have a statute. If you gather a lot more, you can try to put an amendment on the ballot. And then separately, I think in the district court, Prop 8 proponents were interveners. And so the argument would be that maybe the district court decision by Judge Walker could stand because they didn't need standing to be interveners, whereas to appeal, they needed standing. So I think that was the argument that one of the previous callers may have been referring to, that there might be some difference between whether they could appeal, whether the district court might have been able to hear the trial with them as litigators. But my question relates to the other states that haven't legalized gay marriage, but have passed constitutional amendments. I'm not sure I follow the difference between giving rights and taking rights away. Isn't every constitutional amendment taking the right away, whether or not that right exists beforehand? Wouldn't it be an unequal treatment of same-sex couples? Why would it matter for the Equal Protection Clause whether the rights existed at one point or not?
First, thanks, Will, for clarifying some of those details of California law. And looking, I'm in looking on Wikipedia, at least, it does look like perhaps Governor Schwarzenegger was still in the case at the district court level. So you're correct. It may be this would the district court decision would stand, which would then limit the case to applying only in California, at least. And in terms of why it matters, I think that goes back to Romer versus Evans, because that case discussed how when a law seems like it's for solely a punitive action against a certain group, that it's going to be struck down under the Equal Protection Clause. So that is what the Ninth Circuit was arguing. They're saying, hey, it's one thing if you're just keeping you've always defined marriage in this way and you're just going along doing it. As I think it was the Chief Justice pointed out, when the institution of marriage was developed, it certainly wasn't developed thousands of years ago, or at least as far back as we have recorded history, as a purposeful way to exclude homosexuals. It was developed as it part and parcel with the family unit and with procreation, and it just didn't even apply to homosexual relationships because that wasn't an issue. They weren't having children because of basic biological realities. So he said, look, the institution clearly wasn't developed as a method of animus. So the only way you can say there was real animus here and that then triggers heightened scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause is to say that you're taking this away specifically from one group that already had it. I think that's why that distinction is being made.
Right. Next caller.
Hi, this is Mike Erickson again. I asked the first question that started us off. Two follow-up questions. One on that issue of animus and Romer that was just discussed. Could you tell us what discussions there were today regarding animus? Earlier we talked about the narrow ground ruling and the skepticism from the liberal justices on the practical effect. What about just the reality of that? The Ninth Circuit's opinion seems to suggest that the voters themselves were not hateful. It's just their religious beliefs that are hateful. Was that discussed? And then a second question, another topic that's come out in the print news quite prominently is Justice Kennedy's comment with respect to the children of same-sex couples. Could you comment on the just the context of that and what your perceptions were on Justice Kennedy's concerns?
Sure. First of all, animus actually didn't really come up. There was no, ad hominem attacks on the proponents of Prop 8 as being bigots themselves, just saying there is no there's no rational basis, more or less, for it. So I think that was just something we didn't see in the argument. I think the closest thing talking about the animus was when Chief Justice Roberts was saying, I don't think this institution started at the dawn of human history because of animus, but it wasn't something that figured largely in the arguments. In terms of Justice Kennedy's comment, yes, that was actually a really interesting line. He said we have limited sociological information here. He started out saying that we got 5 years of information versus thousands of years of history, but and this was the quote that I had written down. There's 40,000 children of gay couples in California, and the voice of those children is important in this case, isn't it? Very Kennedy-esque kind of almost a poetic reference to the voice of the children. He repeated that phrase a couple times. That was in a question to Chuck Cooper on the proponents of Proposition 8. The answer that Cooper gave, he said, yes, but regardless of what and Justice Kennedy said, these children all want their parents to be married. They feel like there's a benefit to it. Cooper said there actually is simply no data showing that marriage does give any incremental benefits to the children, so they may want it. But as far as we can tell, there has been no study showing that you get something from, as Chief Justice Roberts called it, the label, because in California they have every other right. So it would be inappropriate then to look at the children in terms of saying that we don't, you know, that it's going to help them because we don't have any real evidence it is going to help them. That came up a little bit later. Chief Justice Roberts brought it up, saying, isn't your argument inconsistent because it says, on one side, well, we don't have evidence harm the kids or not. There's no harm proven to kids from the same-sex couple, so you say you have to marry them. But at the same time, there's actually, you presume a harm by if the marriage is denied, but you have no data to presume that. That was in a discussion with Solicitor General Verrilli. So I went back to that, maybe trying to point out again to Justice Kennedy. He said basically you can't have it both ways. You have to either try to, you can't have the burden shifting every time in terms of what you need data to show.
We have about 5 minutes left, 3 questions pending. I'm going to ask our callers to be as succinct as possible with their questions. We'll try and get through as many as possible.
This is Matthew McReynolds from Pacific Justice Institute in California. My question relates to the differences between the district court opinion and the Ninth Circuit opinion. It seemed like certainly the district court took a very harsh approach, and the Ninth Circuit did its best to rehabilitate that in its opinion and steer away from Judge Walker's rhetoric. So I'm wondering if the court today explored any of the differences between those two opinions, or if they focused solely on the Ninth Circuit opinion as to merits.
They really didn't talk about Judge Walker's opinion in great detail. They mentioned maybe in passing some of the record that was created. There was a lot of debate over whether that was properly created or not, and what some of the experts maybe talked about. But even the opponents of Prop 8 acknowledged that there wasn't a large record created on certain issues, having to do with the procreation, simply because that wasn't something that they were looking at. So they didn't really address Judge Walker's opinion at all, and I can't imagine the court going as far as that, as I mentioned earlier. So the only talk, and that wasn't really even explicitly, it was just talking about the general arguments the Ninth Circuit was advancing. That was the only opinion that was at all came into play here.
Let's take another question.
This is Bob Davis in Portland, Maine. First, a great presentation, for which I thank you. My question is a little bit outside the technicalities of the law. It's this. Would it be possible, and would it avoid some of the legal issues, to have the state get rid of the term marriage completely in its laws and call it something like a domestic union contract, allow the clergy to perform or not perform, for lack of a better word, as they see fit, and the churches to decide whether or not to treat it as a sacrament of marriage?
Thanks, Bob. It certainly is possible for states to do that. That said, states have, all 50 states have recognized civil marriage and recognized religious marriages, and at least in certain contexts, as civil marriages as well. So that would be another thing it would be outside of the domain of the court to force states to do that, but certainly any state is free to eliminate civil marriage if it wants to go down that route and just have a purely neutral term if they felt like that would serve their citizens best.
Thank you.
2 more questions left. Let's try and get to both of them.
Hello. This is John Hsu from Newport Beach, California. Carrie and Dean, thank you very much for your presentation. There was an earlier question about the difference in initiative for a statute and initiative for a constitutional amendment in California. And I just wanted to let the group know that the main difference is that in California, in order to get an initiative that affects a statute, you've got to get the number of signatures that's at least 5% of the total votes cast before. And then for a constitutional amendment, it's got to be 8%. And so, in other words, the most recent numbers would be about 500,000 signatures for a ballot initiative that affects the statute and about 810,000 for one that affects a constitutional amendment. And that would have been, those numbers would have been about the same in 2008. And then, Carrie, I wanted to ask a quick question. Today, was there any discussion about full faith and credit, meaning that there has been a lot of discussion about leaving the marriage decision to the states, but I'm wondering if there was any discussion about what happens in the states if somebody from, say, Massachusetts, a couple from Massachusetts, same-sex couple from Massachusetts, wants to move to Alabama, and what happens to that marriage?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. It didn't come up in today's arguments. It falls under DOMA, but it probably won't come up tomorrow particularly either because it's a different section of DOMA than the section that's being challenged. But that's certainly an issue that's working itself out right now in the states.
Thanks. Carrie, do you have time for a final question?
Happy to.
Let's go.
Thank you, Carrie. Paul Johnson in San Francisco. Lawrence versus Texas concerned liberty interests, and I'm curious if there's any discussion or inkling about the difference here where marriage is really the antithesis of freedom, and if there's any consideration in terms of a countervailing liberty interest here, even though, of course, this is an equal protection issue.
Yeah, and that's an issue that didn't really come up. I'm sure that the parties would have liked to talk more about that just in order to get Justice Kennedy's ear, because we know that's something he's particularly interested in. But they did talk about the rights of individuals and some sort of things that hinted at the sort of rights of self-expression and self-identification that are some of the things that Justice Kennedy has talked about in other cases, particularly in the abortion cases and right to privacy, the right to define one's own meaning of existence. So there were people that hinted at issues like that, but it wasn't, as you point out, it wasn't really framed in terms of liberty, because marriage isn't really as much about liberty. It was about denying whether we should be denying something to a certain class, whether it's a class at all, and whether there's reason to deny this state to that class.
Carrie Severino, thank you so much for attending oral argument and for joining us today. I won't say goodbye, but I'll say talk to you soon. To the audience, a reminder and an invitation again to join us for our special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform tomorrow at 1 p.m. when we'll welcome back Carrie Severino as she will attend oral argument tomorrow and brief us on what transpires in the DOMA case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.